You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here on this Anything Goes Summer Thursday. Thank you all so much for the information that was so useful in our understanding what's going on with Higgins yesterday. That was a number of fascinating conversations, and Louise and I learned a lot. Thank you for that. The nuclear, Fukushima is apparently now leaking into the ocean again and badly. Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear is going to be on in the second hour of our program. We're going to be talking about that. The Koch brothers are suggesting if you make more than $34,000 a year, you're in the top 1%. So let's do away with the minimum wage and let's do away with all barriers to labor. No, seriously, they're running an ad and they're saying, you know, Charles Koch said this in an interview. Yeah, the top 1% worldwide. So let's have Americans compete with poor people all over the world for dollar a day wages. What could possibly go wrong? And, well, actually, there's, you know, there's a lot of other things we want to get to here, but Jada Thacker is with us. Jada is a history teacher and the author of Dissecting American History, a Theme-Based Narrative, writing over at consortiumnews.com and reprinted over at alternet.org. An absolutely brilliant piece. Alternet had titled it, and I'm guessing this was a retitle, although maybe not, Concept of Limited Government is Right-Wing Bunk. Try to find anything remotely like it in the Constitution. Jada, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Or Dr. Thacker, I should say.
Yeah.
Indeed. So we've been hearing this meme for the better part of 30 years now, ever since Ronald Reagan said that America is the problem, not the solution, or at least American government, this form of government that George Washington had three horses shot out from underneath him trying to create was somehow the problem, and that smaller government is better, that government that governs least governs best, you know, paraphrasing Thomas Jefferson. Isn't this in the Constitution?
Well, the problem is we have a national myth that circulates American history, and part of that myth is that under the original documents that founded this country, that, you know, everyone was free and there was liberty and all was right in the world. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of interests now that want to try to take us back and say, no, we should go back to those original, you know, the original founding documents, because that's where all our liberty was. Because before these terrible progressive people came and took all our freedoms away. And that's just not the case at all. You know, what we had was a situation that, you know, the founders, the guys that wrote the Constitution, among them, there were no wage earners. There were no people of color. There were no women. You know, these basically were the one percenters of their day. Mm. And they were arranging the situation to benefit their interests, and they did.
Yeah. And they did not establish a limited government. I mean, this is the thing that I found most interesting. Alexander Hamilton, in his report to Congress on manufactures in 1791, when he was the Secretary of the Treasury, he's talking about the general welfare, and he was one of the guys at the Constitutional Convention. I mean, he stormed off in a huff for a while, but he was there. And he writes, the terms general welfare were doubtless intended to signify more than was expressed or imported in those which preceded. Otherwise, numerous exigencies incident to the affairs of a nation would have been left without a provision. The phrase is as comprehensive as any that could have been used, because it was not fit that the constitutional authority of the Union to appropriate its revenue should have been restricted within narrower limits than the general welfare. He has that in quotes. And because this necessarily embraces a vast variety of particulars which are susceptible neither to specification nor definition. It is therefore of necessity left to the discretion of the national legislature to pronounce upon the objects which concern the general welfare. And then he goes on from there. But basically he's saying, you know, the Constitution, when it comes to determining the size of government, the role of government, is almost a blank check.
Well, it was, and Hamilton was among those that wrote it that way. The issue of, the discretion of the federal government was hotly debated during the convention. Unfortunately, and I've gotten a lot of this since the publication of my piece, is that, I have people telling me, hey, look, and then they want to trot out all of these quotes from the Federalist Papers.
Right.
And they are not understanding that the Federalist Papers were not written by a bunch of disinterested policy wonks. These were papers that Hamilton and Jay and Madison wrote as partisan lawyers.
This was a
arguing,
sales pitch for the Constitution, for the ratification of the
arguing
Constitution.
Arguing to get their point, and they got their point when they got the Constitution ratified.
Right.
So it's all well and good for people to sit around and say, well, what was the intent of this and the intent of that? But whatever people were promised, whatever they thought when they heard these arguments or read them, those promises and those arguments were not ratified when the Constitution was ratified. The words of the Constitution were ratified, and those words give the federal government just as much power the day it was ratified as it possesses today.
Right. So what do you say to particularly the Tea Partiers who say, well, what about the enumerated powers? Article 1, Section 8 lists a bunch of things like post office roads, armies. There's specific things the government can do.
Well, I say, yeah, let's go back to Article 1, Section 8, because the very first clause there says that Congress shall have the power to provide for the general welfare of the country.
It takes us back to Hamilton's argument.
Defined, but that is the term that is used in the Constitution. If you skip to the last clause of Article 1, Section 8, it says that's the necessary and proper clause, that Congress shall have the power to make all laws necessary and proper in order to do all of the foregoing. Those two clauses, the first and last of Article 1, Section 8, are bookends.
Right.
And when you put those bookends together, it basically says that Congress has the power to write any legislation that they want to.
Right. The limit on that power, to paraphrase Jefferson, is the people themselves. The people can say, we don't like the way Congress is writing laws, so we're going to vote the bums out and vote some bums in who won't do that. And
exactly. And that's why democratically limited government is absolutely necessary
right. If
this system's going to work. Some people have misconstrued what I've said to say that I am arguing for unlimited government. Well, that's crazy. Nobody thinks totalitarianism is a good idea. I'm just saying that the people that want to suggest, well, if we just could go back to the way the government was the day the Constitution was ratified, all our problems would be solved.
No more blacks voting, no more women voting, indentured.
The vast majority of the public was disenfranchised at that time. It took them 100 years to change that.
Right. Arguably more than that.
Yes.
The Tenth Amendment, we have just a minute left. Your take on the Tenth Amendment.
The Tenth Amendment simply says that any powers not delegated to the United States are reserved to the states and the people, respectively. Now, that is taken to mean, there's important powers that were not given to the federal government that are now inherent in the states. Well, that's not what the Tenth says. If you read it carefully, it says powers not delegated. It didn't say they hadn't already been delegated.
Right.
So the powers, principally the powers in Article 1, Section 8 that we were talking about, those had already been bestowed upon Congress 4 years before the Tenth Amendment was ratified. So the Tenth Amendment was, they just closed the pasture gate after the horses were already out.
Brilliant article. Dr. Jadda Thacker, hang on just a second here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In the article, Concept of Limited Government is Right-Wing Bunk. You can read it over Consortium News or Alternet. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, the guy who questioned the wisdom of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 when he was first running for office, finds himself at the center of yet another race-related controversy this week. Yesterday, the Washington Free Beacon published an article titled Rebel Yell, which detailed the previous career of Rand Paul's right-hand man, a guy by the name of Jack Hunter. He co-authored Rand Paul's first book. While working as a radio host in South Carolina, Hunter apparently appeared wearing in public, wearing a Confederate flag mask, openly called for secession, and defended the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. This is Rand Paul's wingman, right? He called himself the Southern Avenger. He was the chairman of the Charleston wing of the League of the South, a group which, according to its own website, quote, advocates the secession and subsequent independence of the Southern states from this forced union and the formation of a Southern Republic. Right. Rand Paul is trying to now separate himself from Hunter. That's going to be kind of hard because the Southern Avenger isn't just some random staffer on his Senate staff. He's a good buddy of Rand Paul's. He helped him write his first book, The Tea Party Goes to Washington, back in 2010. So it now looks like Senator Paul is continuing in a great family tradition. I mean, even though he denies responsibility, his father, Ron Paul, published a series of racist newsletters during a 1996 congressional campaign. And we really shouldn't be all that surprised by either Ron or Rand Paul's connection to far-right racism, and that's because they're libertarians. And libertarianism is the velvet glove over the iron fist of racism. Here's how it works. When you have an entrenched racial and economic class that has ruled a continent for five centuries, they have well established the levers and the levels of power and wealth. And they will and do, generation after generation, do whatever is necessary to hang on to that wealth and power. History shows us this. I mean, you know, the history of Reconstruction, the whole history of integration in the 50s and 60s, that the only thing strong enough to challenge the political and economic power of a multi-century hereditary ruling class, particularly one based on race, is the power of government. It was government that made Alabama Governor George Wallace and Georgia Governor Lester Maddox integrate their states. It was government that both passed and made the South finally accept the 14th and 15th Amendments. Here's George Wallace in his inaugural address as governor of Alabama back in 1963.
I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Yeah, that tyranny he was talking about was government, right? Federal government. But Wallace lost that fight because the power of government, when appropriately used, is greater than the power of wealth, class, or race. It took government to break the stranglehold of white rule in the 1870s and 1880s. But even that white power structure reasserted itself and fought to reclaim its power, leading to Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896, which set up a half century or more of segregation, legal apartheid right here in the United States, which kept into place the political and economic privileges of white people. So now along comes a political philosophy, libertarianism, that says everything is fine, everything's equal, government should just get the hell out of the way. They say this when the median net worth of a white family in the United States is $110,700 and that of a black family is $4,000. They say this when in the entire history of the U.S. Senate, there have only been three African Americans elected to that body. They say this when just 20 minutes after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the biggest and most populous state of the old Confederacy, Texas, immediately put into place discriminatory voter suppression laws and began gerrymandering. So in effect, when conservatives and libertarians say government should get out of the way, what they're really saying is let's lock into place white political power, white wealth, and white privilege. Of course, not all libertarians think of themselves as racist and most probably don't see how their get rid of government policies prop up institutional bigotry. But the reality is that when you blast government as the root of all evil, when you neuter its power, you end up weakening the only thing that can keep the ruling elite, a racial ruling elite, in check. And when you do that, the rich and powerful race hangs on to their wealth and power, and the poorer minorities lose even more of what little they have. You know, in the end, it really doesn't matter whether Rand Paul agrees with Jack Hunter that the Confederacy was a good idea. He's trying to say, Because by going on and on about states' rights and freedom from government tyranny, sort of like old George Wallace, Senator Rand Paul and his friends on the libertarian right make sure that the values of old Dixie and an entrenched racial elite and racial inequality continue in the United States. Libertarianism truly is the velvet glove of a nice-sounding freedom policy, a glove that covers the iron fist of 500 years of genocide and apartheid in the United States, that covers the iron fist of white privilege, that covers the iron fist that to this day continues, of discrimination and repression, of suppression of rights, of suppression of voting rights, of suppression of economic rights. Libertarianism is the velvet glove over the iron fist of racism. I know there's all these young people, oh, I'm a libertarian, it sounds so cool. Yeah, just think about what it means, though. 27 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Got any libertarians out there who want to disagree? Give me a call. Good luck. Oh, this is how insane it gets. Welcome back. Ken Cuccinelli, the guy who wants to be, you know, he's the number two guy in Virginia. He wants to be the governor. He's come out and he says he wants health insurance to work the way car insurance works, right? The way car insurance works, when your car is smashed up, then they'll fix your car. But if you need to have the oil checked or the brakes, car insurance doesn't cover that. He doesn't think that doctor's visits should be covered by health insurance. These are the modern Republicans. This is how these guys think. I mean, he's saying this. He's running for governor. And this is part of his, this is his shtick. Oh, health insurance shouldn't cover doctor's visits. Down in Alabama, where if you earn over $1,332 a year, yeah, you heard that right. That's about $105 a month, or $110. It'd be about $115 a month. If you, $30 a week, $40 a week. If you earn over $1,332 a year, you are too rich to qualify for Medicaid, for health insurance for poor people. In Alabama. Well, another one of these right-wing taker states. They take more money from you and me, from the rest of us taxpayers, than they send to the federal government. The blue states are the maker states. The red states are the taker states. One of these right-wing Republican taker states. You got to make less than $1,332 a year to qualify for health insurance as a poor person. And if you are out of work and can't find a job, you qualify for TANF benefits. This is what we used to call welfare until Bill Clinton took a meat axe to it. Of $190 a month for a family of two. Yeah. Pay for your food, pay for your rent. $190 a month. It's pretty amazing. It was so amazing that Ricky Lawrence Gardner, who is 49 years old, lives in Moulton, Alabama, and has a job, but he injured his leg so badly that it's preventing him from working, and he was about to lose his job, and he knew that this is what he's looking at. Right, living on $190 a month, which would be too much to qualify him for free health insurance, and he's got an injury. So here's what he did yesterday. He walked into a bank in Moulton, Alabama, with a note that said, "I have a gun, give me your money." Handed it to the teller handed him a bag of money, took the money, walked out to his car, tossed the money in his car, closed the door, sat on the trunk, or sat on the hood, and waited for the police to show up. Because in jail, he'll get health care, and he'll get fed, and he'll have a place to sleep. Although Alabama has some of the worst jails in America, and they're running at about twice what their designed for capacity is, and so it's going to be a hellhole, but apparently it's better than the homeless hellhole in Alabama. What does this say about America? Well, here's what Charles Koch thinks it says about America. He's got a solution. He's going to solve the problem. Poverty and homelessness and low wages and no access to health insurance. The Charles Koch Foundation. You can find their ad over at charlescochfoundation.org. The Charles Koch Foundation is running a new TV ad, $200,000 ad buy, in which they point out that if you are earning more than $32,400, well, we'll play the ad and you can hear it yourself. I may not have the number right. You're just like Charles Koch. You're in the top 1%. You are a 1%er. Here's the ad.
Are you in the 1%? Well, if you earn over $34,000 a year, you are one of the wealthiest 1% in the world. That is the power of economic freedom. People in the most economically free countries earn, on average, over 8 times more than people in the least free.
Yeah,
the poor earn 10
like
times
Canada
as much.
It continues with this kind of nonsense. And so if you earn $34,000 a year, you too are a 1%er. So the Wichita Eagle, he lives in Kansas, sat down with him and said, let's talk about this. And he said, okay, cool. He said, we need to do a better job of raising up the disadvantaged and the poorest in this country rather than saying, oh, we're just fine now. Anything that people can do, people with limited capital can do to raise themselves up, that would be poor people, and keep throwing obstacles in their way. And so we've got to clear those out, or the minimum wage, or anything that reduces the mobility of labor, he explained to the Eagle. So Charles Koch's answer to this, and he's running this TV ad, is do away with the minimum wage. Do away with it. We don't need no stinking minimum wage. And let's do away with any laws that limit the mobility of labor. Now, what does that mean, the mobility of labor? It means the ability of people to move from one country to another so that they can get a job. In other words, unlimited immigration into the United States or unlimited outsourcing out of the United States. In other words, as he started out with his ad, hey, you make $34,000 a year, you're in the top 1%. Now, top 1%, that's pretty rarefied territory. Shouldn't most people be in the 50 percentile? So, I mean, you know, right now, top 1%, 34 grand a year, you're a rich guy. So let's compete instead with the people who are making a dollar a day, which is about 1 billion people on this planet. or $2 a day, a couple billion people on this planet. So let's set it up so that $600 a year, $800 a year, $900 a year, well, we can go back to Alabama. I mean, they've set the benchmark for us. $1,332 a year. You make more than that, you are rich. You're too rich to qualify for government-subsidized health care. I just don't know how to respond to that other than just shocked, amazed, amusement, I guess. Well, it's really tragic, actually, that we've got somebody worth $40-plus billion lecturing us on how rich we are and how we should do away with the minimum wage. Has he no shame? Andre in Poughkeepsie, New York. Hey, Andre, what's up?
Hey, I am... I'm neither Republican or Democrat, so...
Which is what old Republicans usually say.
No, actually, I'm independent, and 100% okay. Independent. I don't like Republicans any more than I like Democrats. So that's just the way it is. I would say that I wanted to speak first about the Constitution, but I don't have a lot of time. I know you're not... You don't have a lot of time for people to ramble on, so I'm just going to go to the other issue that you brought up. Which was it's always cloaked in the women's right or their rights of choice. But when we're talking about the birth control, that was actually utilized as a way to cut back the reproduction of minorities. And it was first started in the 1960s. They started doing the testing, and it drove all the way up through the 1970s when they really started to propagandize.
Yeah, and the opposite argument of that is Pat Buchanan's argument that you know, people get wealthier and they're more likely to use birth control, they're more likely to have access to or use abortions, and so white people are not reproducing as much as brown people, and God forbid.
Right.
Not going to go there, Andre. John in La Crescenta, California. It's a sad and insane argument. Hey, John, what's up?
It's a pleasure to talk to you, sir. First, an observation that people who are embarrassed to call themselves Republicans call themselves libertarians.
Yeah.
And secondly, Booz Allen Hamilton has been relieved of responsibility for the Snowden event by the Air Force. To me, it seems incredible that this guy would work for these people for 3 months and have access to this kind of information.
Yeah.
I think he did a lot of good by revealing the fact that Booz Allen has.
I find it amazing that Booz Allen, that any private corporation is spying on Americans and that we're outsourcing our spy. I mean, again, I don't mind the United States of America having a spy agency. It's a good and important thing. There should be appropriate oversight. The Fourth Amendment should be respected. But when we start outsourcing it to private corporations, it's worse than the private prison business.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And then you outsource it to Booz Allen, which is owned in part by the Carlyle Group. And the Carlyle Group used to be owned in part by the Bin Laden family. I mean, really? Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Robert Reich nails it. He's just, this is from his Facebook page, you know, it's facebook.com/Robert Reich. And he just asked this question. And so I'll ask you this question. We can chew on this for a couple hours if you'd like. There's a lot of other stuff we're going to be talking about. In fact, at the top of the next hour, Ted Nordhaus is going to be with us. Telling us that environmentalism is dead and long live nuclear energy. Okay. Oh, man, it's going to be entertaining. Anyhow, Robert Reich asked the question, suppose a small group of extremely wealthy people sought to systematically destroy the U.S. government by, one, finding and bankrolling new candidates pledged to shrinking and dismembering it, 2, intimidating or bribing many current senators and representatives to block all proposed legislation, prevent the appointment of presidential nominees, eliminate funds to implement and enforce laws, and threaten to default on the nation's debt. 3, taking over state governments in order to redistrict, gerrymander, require voter IDs, purge voter rolls, and otherwise suppress the votes of the majority in federal elections. 4, running a vast PR campaign designed to convince the American public of certain big lies, such as climate change isn't occurring. And 5, buying up the media so that the public cannot know the truth. Would you call this treason? Asks Robert Reich. What do you think? Would you? Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell. Mitch McTurtle had it out today in the United States Senate. Here is, via the New York Times, here is, which is probably via C-SPAN, here is Harry Reid's comments, followed by Mitch McTurtle, Mitch McConnell. Hang on just a minute. Let me mute that. It is throwing an advertisement at me. So in 10 seconds, I will share with you Harry Reid, followed by Mitch McTurtle. I thought I had it queued up, but apparently they've figured out a new, slick new way to. But Harry Reid, what he's talking about here we go.
The Senate confirmed 80 of his executive nominees. By the 4th of July of President Bush's second term, Senate confirmed 118. By the 4th of July of this year, President Obama, 34. These procedural blockades are as obvious as they are unprecedented. Yet the Republican leader says, there's no problem here. The status quo is fine.
No droids in this car.
Consistent and unprecedented obstruction by this Republican caucus has turned advise and consent into deny and obstruct. Republican obstruction has denied President Obama the ability to choose his team. Whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent, we should all be able to agree that presidents deserve the team members they want.
What this is about is manufacturing a pretext for a power grab.
Here's Mitch McTurtle.
I want everybody to understand this is no small matter we're talking about here. And I guarantee you it's a decision that if they actually go through with it, they will live to regret.
A threat.
Look, when the founders wrote advise and consent, I don't think they had in mind sit down and shut up.
No, they said advise and consent, not refuse.
And it's noteworthy that all of the people he's complaining about all got confirmed. So no. What he's really saying here is he don't want any debate at all in connection with presidential appointments. Just sit down, shut up, and rubber stamp everything.
Isn't that amazing how Mitch McTurtle can just, like, you know, turn reality inside out? It's incredible. So Harry Reid is seriously considering a limited nuclear option where he will say it only takes 51 votes to confirm a presidential nominee, specifically to the National Labor Relations Board and the Consumer Protection Group, you know, Richard Cordray. So we'll see. David in Pompano Beach, Florida. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to thank you and your associates there for your dedication and to the country and to us out here that are progressive and what you're doing.
Thank you.
And my question is, if people making $34,000 are the 1%, how many zeros and decimal points to the left does that put Mr. Polk? I'm not a mathematician. So.
Yeah, I can't do math that fast in my head. But, you know, there's an old saying, you know, I think it was Lincoln who used to quote this, that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. And that's really what's going on here, is this: we're being sold a big lie that because somebody making $34,000 a year is in the top 1% of the globe. And I've spent time out in that globe. I have been in very, very poor countries. I've worked in slums and favelas and famine zones, in fact, in India, in Africa, in South America, in Central America, in Southeast Asia, in the Philippines, in the United States, for that matter, and in Mexico. And you don't want to be in the bottom 50% of the world. I mean, it is really, really, really rough. David, thank you for the call. Excellent rhetorical question. Frank in Port Orange, Florida. Hey, Frank.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a former truck driver, but I used to listen to you. You kept me awake many hours driving over the road.
Oh, good.
I was laid off 3 years ago, and I'm not doing anything anymore. I miss your show, and I just happened to catch you the other day.
Okay.
I just wanted to talk about one thing. We had Ronald Reagan there 25 years ago. He went into the Social Security money. He took money from the program to balance his budget with Tip O'Neill. And, of course, 25 years later, it's come back to haunt us. The Republican Party has been doing things like this here for years and years. They've got a legislature that doesn't want to work right now. I think President Obama can do one thing. We could enact a federal program for the Social Security program where in every federal bank that we fund and back with our federal stamp of approval, we put a lottery machine in them. In that lottery machine, every bank, $5 a ticket, that money goes directly to Washington, D.C., a deposit each and every day. We give out $1 million a week in 50 states every
year. Yeah. Frank, I'm not excited about
it. You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is interesting. Ted Norhaus is with us. He is the chairman of the Breakthrough Institute. The website is thebreakthrough.org. And, Ted, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's The Breakthrough, right? Because I just typed in
Breakthrough, correct.
Breakthrough, and I got something else. Okay, The at the very beginning.
Yeah, Breakthrough will get you. I don't know what it'll get you, but it's not going to get you out.
Okay. Let me put the in there and see what comes up. Okay, there we go. All right, Neoclassical Mythmaking, How Not to Think About the Economy by Michael Lind. Very interesting. So you write that cap and trade is actually you're writing in favor of nuclear power, and you're saying that trying to use cap and trade to control carbon regulation or carbon emissions doesn't work and is a bad idea. Do I have that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, what we have had a long-standing view that if you want to get to a global economy that is going to meet the needs of 9 billion people without emitting carbon, that's a creative enterprise. It's not a restrictive enterprise. You've got to go build an entirely new energy economy. You're not going to regulate your way to a global clean energy economy.
Okay, so if you want to deregulate, if you want to do away with the government's role in things, why don't we do away with Price-Anderson, the law that causes you and me and every other taxpayer in America to subsidize the nuclear power industry?
Well, to be clear, what I said was that we're not going to regulate our way there. We need to invest our way there.
Okay, so you're all,
we've been long-time supporters,
so you're all in favor of backing, because as you well know, if you and I stopped insuring the nuclear industry, no insurance company in the world would insure them, and they would go out of business tomorrow because they are so dangerous.
Well, that's not actually the case.
Well, they're so dangerous in the minds of the insurance companies, maybe not in your mind. But
no, that's not even actually. I mean, I'll just make two points. One is that's actually not clear. You can argue that it's a subsidy we should get rid of, but
well, please name one country in the world that does not backstop their nuclear industry in order to, and instead throws it upon the tender mercies of Lloyd's of London.
I think there are actually a number of countries that use different ways. I mean, let me say this, which is that we cap liability on all sorts of things that we decide are social goods, whether that's medical malpractice, whether that is hydroelectric dams, which also have liability caps. And we've decided that there are very low probability events that are very difficult in advance to anticipate what the costs are going to be. And so we've capped liability for the nuclear industry.
Well, I say let's do away with capping liability for medical malpractice. We actually don't do that in all states. There are a lot of states that don't cap medical malpractice. You're talking about so-called tort reform. And there are places that don't cap, you know, the liabilities on hydro. These are basically industries that have gotten government welfare. And well, with regard to cap and trade, are you not familiar with what George Herbert Walker did?
If you don't want renewables, get rid of the subsidies for renewables. If you don't want nuclear, get rid of the subsidies for nuclear. But then don't turn around and tell me that you want to reduce global emissions by 80%.
What about the subsidies for the fossil fuel industry?
Pardon?
Why don't we get rid of the subsidies for the fossil fuel industry?
I'm all for getting rid of the subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, but don't think that if you get rid of those subsidies, fossil fuels are going away, because they're not.
No, they won't, but you realize the cost of oil will be over $250 a barrel tomorrow if you did away with all the subsidies for the fossil fuel industry.
No, it wouldn't be.
Of course it would. You would. Who's going to pay for the Fifth Fleet to protect our shipping lanes?
Pardon?
Who's going to pay for the Fifth Fleet to protect our shipping lanes? If you take the amount of oil that this country uses...
If you're going to attribute every dollar that we spend on military spending...
No, I'm not taking every dollar.
...fossil energy. What about...
I'm taking 10% of our military budget.
You want to...
It's $100 a barrel.
...to coal. I mean, really, for climate change, the big issue is coal, not oil. Now let's talk about subsidies for coal.
Okay, you've got the major subsidy is that they are externalizing their costs, their externalities. They're dumping their externalities on you and me. The coal industry does not pay to dispose of their waste.
So
you and I pay for it.
Internalize,
and they're internalizing their profits.
Externality you can for coal, and coal still is not going away. It's not going to go away here, and it's definitely not going to go away in China and India.
I think we go away rather fast, and China is spending money like crazy. You know, China just put a cap-and-trade program into place in Shenzhen. They're doing what George Herbert Walker Bush did back in the 90s.
If you think that cap-and-trade program is going to move China away from coal, you are crazy.
Well, I watched George Herbert Walker Bush do it with sulfur dioxide. We had a problem back in the 80s with acid rain. It was killing our lakes. It was killing our wildlife. It was ruining our national monuments. It was eating the paint off people's cars. And so George Herbert Walker Bush said, let's put cap and trade on sulfur emissions from power plants into place. He put into place, Democrats and Republicans together, put into place a cap and trade program. And within a decade, we had pretty much solved the acid rain problem.
Sulfur dioxide is like carbon. You're also crazy. It's not the same thing. You have to completely decarbonize your energy system to have an impact on climate change.
Exactly.
And there's enormous, it is, you have to actually change the underlying generation technology.
Exactly.
Carbon capture and storage. You're not going to do it through a cap and trade program. You're not going to do it through scrubbers.
Sure you can.
You have to actually replace the entire infrastructure. So do not compare.
You've got over 20 countries in Europe that are doing cap and trade on carbon right now. Are you trying to tell me that I'm crazy and they are crazy too?
They're doing cap and trade on carbon right now, and it has had no demonstrable impact on emissions anywhere in the world.
They are all reducing their carbon emissions. You've got the Northeast states that have put together a compact on essentially cap and trade. I mean, it's not a legal one, but they're reducing their emissions.
Program and is building coal plants as fast as they can. There's something like 20 coal plants going online in Germany in the next decade under their cap and trade program. European emissions were falling faster before they put cap and trade in place than afterwards.
Then, if that's true, let's do something about that. Okay, let's assume that you're right.
Tell me if cap and trade is working if it's not working because
okay,
it's
well
not.
Let's just do a car. You know, that's fine. Let's just do a carbon tax. Let's say if you are going to produce an externality, which is the death and destruction of millions and millions of people and billions of dollars worth of property. I mean, you've got large chunks of the United States now that are functionally uninsurable. Virtually every marina in the state of Florida, for example, uninsurable. Why? Because of the externality of the fossil fuel industry, carbon dioxide. So let's just put a carbon tax on this stuff. Let's just say, you know, it costs about $100 a ton to society for these guys to be emitting carbon, so we're going to charge them for that.
Have carbon taxes. There is virtually no evidence that those carbon taxes have had any impact on their emissions. So you want a carbon tax because you think it's the moral thing to do.
So you're telling me that
no evidence that you get to that you have any impact on global emissions or even on national emissions with cap and trade program or carbon taxes. Do you want to try it again? Go keep banging
yes.
your head against the same wall?
Yes.
Go
put a carbon
it.
Tax on.
But sometimes, you know, there's a...
Why are you so afraid of a carbon tax?
I'm not afraid of a carbon tax. I'm telling
okay,
you...
Okay, why don't you support
work.
It then?
Pardon?
Why don't you support it?
I do support a carbon tax.
Okay, what do you think it should be? I mean, the lowest end of what carbon is actually costing us, the amount of money that ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers are squeezing out of us is around $30 a ton. The high end is around $200 a ton. Where do you think the carbon tax should be?
I think we should have a low and rising carbon tax, and I think we should use the proceeds to fund investments in clean energy technology.
Okay,
and you
I agree.
Can wave your hands about, look, these estimates of the social cost of carbon are basically estimates. Tell me what you want the cost to be, and then go build a model that justifies it.
No, I would use the numbers from Swiss Re. I'd use the reinsurance industry numbers.
We actually live in. And what that
right.
is today is maybe, and probably not even that, about $10 a ton.
Yeah, in your dreams, Ted. Ted Nordhaus, you can read all about it at thebreakthrough.org. Thanks, Ted.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, carbon tax, cap and trade, do nothing? I don't think do nothing is an option. I'm going to have to do a source watch on this one. I'm wondering who funds the Breakthrough Institute? WATCH. Here we are, sourcewatch.org. And let's type in breakthrough and see what happens. And I beg your pardon? Oh, cool. Thank you for the reminder. Kevin Camps is with us. He is the nuclear waste watchdog at Beyond Nuclear, beyondnuclear.org. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Tom.
We just had a fellow from the Breakthrough Institute telling us how wonderful nuclear power was. Mm. Actually, he was trying to. We kind of got sidetracked on carbon taxes and my being crazy. But in any case, I understand that, the guy who was sort of the original hero of Fukushima, who stayed and tried to keep the plant from melting down, just died of cancer. And
yeah.
B, that some of the nuclear watchdogs in the Fukushima area in Japan are saying that there's just a naked leak of radiation into the ocean. Take your choice, whichever one you want to talk about first.
Well, Yoshida, you know, he did defy Tokyo Electric when they told him to stop cooling the melting down reactors with salt water because they wanted to preserve them for future commercial use, which was insane. They were so in denial. And he disregarded their orders, and he cooled as best he could the reactors with salt water. Unfortunately, he could not stop them from melting down. And, you know, the devil's in the details as to how much radioactivity has gotten out, but that's the latest news that you're saying that's breaking is that, you know, it looks like the New York Times reported just today, based on the Nuclear Regulatory Authority's chief spokesperson, that the leaks have been going on for 2 years into the ocean from Fukushima.
Yikes.
And they have surged recently in the last days and weeks to much higher levels, something like 100 times the level of cesium and strontium and tritium that's been previously seen in the groundwater near the seaside and even in the ocean itself just offshore.
Wow.
So he admitted they don't know where the leak is occurring. They don't know how to stop it.
So, and cesium does what to the human body?
Cesium is a muscle seeker, and it has caused, for example, in Ukraine and Belarus and Russia, a condition called Chernobyl heart, even in children, which is holes in the heart congenitally.
Okay, and strontium does what to human beings?
Strontium is a bone seeker that causes various bone maladies, including in the bone marrow.
Including bone cancer and leukemia?
Yeah.
Okay, and what was the third element you said?
Tritium, which is radioactive hydrogen, which is also a clinically proven cause of cancer and birth defects and genetic damage.
And this stuff is just literally pouring out of Fukushima right now as we speak.
They have like 100 tons or more of leakage into the basement levels of water, groundwater, on a regular basis, and that's where it's picking up its contamination and then leaking apparently into the ocean after that.
And that's the same Pacific Ocean that ends up from Oregon all the way down to Southern California on our side of the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, and the ocean currents, even certain forms of seafood like tuna, actually bring it over here pretty quickly because they're actually swimming, migrating. So, it's the bioaccumulation in the food chain that we really need to worry about. Some people might try to dismiss this as not important because the ocean is so big, the radioactivity will dilute. But the bioaccumulation is what reverses that process, and we sit at the top of the food chain.
Right. Now, I know, some time back we talked, and you were telling me about efforts, volunteer groups who are putting together monitoring stations, both for air and water, but also looking for things like cesium in the fish. What's the status of that?
Well, the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network is one of the great coalitions happening in North America, and they're really urging the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to take this issue seriously, to put official federal monitoring at a much higher alert level on the food that's, coming from the ocean, that's even being imported from Japan, because our regulations are much weaker than Japan's. Japan allows for 100 becquerels per kilogram of radioactive cesium in food. Beyond that, it's considered unfit for human consumption. Incredibly, in the U.S., the standard is 1,200 becquerels per kilogram. So we used to be importing Japanese contaminated food into the United States.
Whoa. And is this Japanese contaminated food that is too radioactive for Japan, so they're exporting it? You're talking about seafood?
All food. Even crops that are being grown, not just in Fukushima Prefecture, but in adjacent prefectures.
So, it's like rice?
Yes, you name it. I mean, I've checked the International Atomic Energy Agency website from time to time to see the list grow of the various foods that are being contaminated in Japan and at certain different levels.
Now, this is what could be and what the levels are. What is actually being measured? You have, hey, this group of 15 people in Portland, Oregon just discovered, in this restaurant, salmon that kicks a Geiger counter at this point. Is there anything like that?
I think it's still in the initial stages to try to set up those kind of systems. I mean, it's even been forced on the people of Japan to do their own food analysis because their government, which is in bed with the nuclear industry, isn't doing anywhere near an adequate job. So, for example, there's a family in Osaka that has set up its own food monitoring system. They paid something like $10,000 or $15,000 to acquire it from Ukraine, of all places, who have to deal with the aftermath of Chernobyl. And they are checking the food not only for their own children, but for their children's schoolmates. And so they've set up kind of a single elementary school guarding its own children's food supply. But that's...
And what are they finding?
Well, I haven't heard recently, but they are on guard against their children eating any contaminated food above a certain level.
Yeah, amazing. And that above the certain level, that's where the devil's in the details, because there is no safe level of radiation.
That's right. Artificial radioactivity is harmful. There is a risk of cancer.
Period. No nukes. BeyondNuclear.org is the website. Kevin Camps, the Nuclear Waste Watchdog. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Always great talking to you. If you want more information, get over to BeyondNuclear.org. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, are libertarians racist? What's the best way to provide energy for the future? Is global warming real? What about cap and trade? Lots going on here. Oh, and I got to tell you about George Zimmerman. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on Anything Goes Summer. Oh, Robert Reich's Facebook page, thank you for this, Sue, is facebook.com/RBReich, R-E-I-C-H, just as an FYI. And, yes, turmeric and curcumin, I consider to be a wonder drug, and I'll just leave it at that. You can Google it yourself or DuckDuckGo it. And Tom in Chester, New York, you think libertarians are not promoting the status quo and thus a racist society. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I couldn't help but get in to your last guest, the debate on energy and all.
Mm-hmm.
I came up with another question I wanted to pick your brain.
Okay.
If I developed an energy source, let's just say I built a car that could run on water. You know, everyone has those discussions. What would happen to me? Do you think I would make money, or what would happen?
I think a lot of people would want to buy your car. I would.
Yeah, that would be great, but I would expect that I would be shut down somehow by the powers that be. The oil industry, you don't think that would happen?
No, I don't.
No.
I don't.
So
they're not shutting down the solar industry. I mean, they would lobby very aggressively for Congress not to give you any subsidies. I mean, you know, look at the and then they probably, you know, run a disinformation campaign saying that your water powered car is just, you know, not ready for price. But, you know, hey, if you've got a good product, I mean the solar industry is breaking through that stuff. Wind power is generating 20% of all the electricity in the state of Texas right now.
Well, that's good. And I just remember that movie, Tucker, when he built a better car and they shut him down. Remember that movie?
I never saw the movie, but I remember all the discussion of it. I don't think that it's quite that simple, although the fact of the matter is that back during the latter half of the 19th century, I mean, this is what the Sherman Act was designed to protect against. You had John Rockefeller, his principal business model was to destroy his competitors by collusion. He would cut deals with the railroad barons where they would simply refuse or set the prices so high it was functional refusal to transport the kerosene, the refined products, or even the crude oil of John Rockefeller's competitors. And, you know, that earned him the wrath of the state of Ohio and got him kicked out of Ohio and why he moved to New Jersey. But it's, you know, today I think given the Internet and given how things spread, you know, I hear these things about, oh, there's this wonderful new technology. We've got, you know, lithium, whatever, something or other, nuclear power plants and this, that. And I think if something actually works, somebody will figure out a way to make it happen. And that's why you've got a lot of communities in the third world, you know, in India and in parts of Africa where they have no fossil fuel energy, where they're literally going from wood as their energy source, leapfrogging right into solar power. There you've got, you know, groups that are putting, you know, a solar panel in the tree and, you know, or on a pole and using that to power. Go ahead.
Isn't this what we have? Because I listen to everybody. I listen to the right wing stations, and they talk about, oh, it doesn't work, and that's because what I understand, they're protecting the oil. They want oil to be the main energy source, so they're going to wreck any new technology that comes out. Oh no, that's no good. And for whatever reason,
well, that's what I said. They may say it, but they can't stop it.
Well, if that's the case, I would think that we would start seeing. Like you just said, if I had a car that could run on water, if it was going to work, it would start, you know, you build a better mousetrap.
Yeah, you got the Tesla. It runs on electricity. The Tesla is doing really, really well. Everybody said it was going to fail. They're making money. They got a loan from the federal government to kickstart their operation. It was part of the Obama stimulus package. They paid it back.
But that's... Okay, wait. You just touched on something. If you need a loan from the government, why do you need a loan? I mean, people are going to come to buy a product. Why do you need to get a loan from the government?
Well, some things require a certain amount of scale. If you want to, you know, Tom, if you wanted to start a company that is building something that's relatively small, you can make it in your garage. You could build a half a dozen prototypes, or you can make, you know, small production units of it. That's one thing. If it's slightly larger, you might need a couple hundred grand from the bank or something like that. But if you need tens of millions of dollars to build a factory that's going to build a car, you're not going to find a lot of sources for that other than venture capitalists who were not loaning money to anybody or giving money to anybody back during the crash or the government.
Right.
And so, you know, if it's a good investment, I mean, it turns out that the Obama investments were good investments. Tom, I got to move along, but if you're an inventor and you've got a brilliant idea, don't stop. We need more of them. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, you said earlier that the government was the check against the wealthy elite.
No, what I said was the government is the check against racism.
Okay. Well, if you consider, like, the Koch brothers and the wealthy elite, the libertarians, the Coors, the John Birch Society.
Right.
I would submit that And I'm sure you agree with this. I'm just going to put it out there just to clarify that it's political movements, it's people causing trouble that forces the hand of government to concede those rights to people.
Absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. But see, the fact of the matter is that the people, you know, Martin Luther King had a power to which he could appeal, which was the government. You know, ultimately Lyndon Johnson and Jack Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. And company and Congress and all that kind of thing. So in the absence of government, and this is what the Koch brothers and the libertarians and all the right ringers are saying, you know, government is bad, government is the problem, blah, blah, let's get rid of government, let's enfeeble government, let's disempower government. In the absence of government, then the status quo, particularly when it comes to things like racial discrimination, stands. Because government is the only thing that has the sufficient force, and let's call it what it is. It is force. I mean, libertarians will say, you know, government is the ability of people to show up at your house with a gun. Right. And so, you know, when Lester Maddox stood in front of that school with his axe handle, or George Wallace said, no, you're not going to integrate our schools, segregation now, segregation forever. Bobby Kennedy came in and said, no, I got a couple soldiers here. They got guns.
Right. I agree. I do want to say there's a host of things I would like to talk about, so I'll have to call back some other time.
Yeah.
Next week or something.
Okay. Pick one right now, unless we just did.
Okay. We need a constitutional amendment that with some kind of wording, and I'm not sure how the wording would go, but we need an amendment that would allow, that would give the power to more people, a more participatory democracy. Democracy, because right now half the people don't vote. They think, you know, the government doesn't do anything for me.
Right.
And the other half think they only have a choice between Democrats and Republicans. And
I would just think that, by and large, that's the reality.
Yeah, that is the reality. There needs to be an amendment where more people have a say in how things are actually, how things go.
Yeah. There's two ways to make that happen that I know of, Noah, and maybe you know of some others. One is to have more publicly funded elections. Right now, basically, if you're going to run for Congress, you've either got to be very, very rich, like Daryl Issa, so you can fund your own campaigns, or have a bunch of rich buddies who will do so, or you got to be willing to sell out to rich people who will fund your campaigns, and then you end up with things like all the Republicans in Wisconsin and Michigan who are in the pockets of the Koch family or the DeVos family, that kind of thing. So, you know, public funding of elections would allow average working people to run for Congress again. We used to have that. It used to be, you know, average working people would run for Congress because money was not playing such a large role. So public financing of elections would go a long way in that direction. Number two, you want to break the stranglehold of the two-party system and at the same time clean up both parties, make, you know, have them be more responsive to their people and more high-integrity organizations do ranked voting. Or variations of that. In New York State, you got fusion voting. You can vote for the Liberal Party candidate who is also the Democratic candidate, or it could be Republican. I mean, John Lindsay ran for mayor of New York City and won mayor of New York City as a Republican because he was also endorsed by the Liberal Party and he was on the ticket as the Liberal Party. And if you had he not had the votes from people who voted Liberal Party for John Lindsay for mayor, and this was back in the 50s or 60s. I was a wee little one. But had you not had those Liberal votes, because that was back when you had Liberal Republicans, had you not had that, Lindsay would have lost the election. And so, you know, that's fusion voting or some variation on it. But the real, you know, prize is to do what New Zealand and Australia have done, which is ranked voting or instant runoff voting. And we've done that in several hundred communities across the United States. The largest is San Francisco. And that's where you vote. To take the example of the 2000 election, you know, we lived in Vermont. Louise and I split our votes. She voted for Al Gore. I voted for Ralph Nader. But if we had ranked voting, I could, because we knew that the state was going to go Democratic. And I wanted the Green Party to get that 5% threshold. If I'd lived in a swing state, I would have voted for Al Gore. But the fact of the matter is, with ranked voting or instant runoff voting, I could have said Ralph Nader's my first choice, Al Gore's my second choice. They would have counted the ballots. They would have said, okay, Ralph Nader, there's no way he's going to win, so all those votes are going to roll over to become whatever the second choice is. Most of them would be Al Gore choices. And so, you know, you could do that. The third option, by the way, is proportional representation, where you vote for a party, and then that party puts the person in. So if a party gets 15% of the vote, they get 15% of the seats in the legislature. And there's actually a way to do that state by state across the United States as well. So, Noah, you got any alternatives? No?
No.
Okay. Well, that's a place to start. And I'd suggest that you look into those options, because there are national organizations that are pushing for every single one of those things that you can join.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And by joining movement politics, as the old cliche goes, it's a cliche because it's true, you become part of the solution instead of part of the problem. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. The Tom Hartman Program here with you. Speaking the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. You're not going to hear about global free trade and what a noxious thing it is pretty much anywhere else, certainly not on the corporate media. And this is a really scary thing. In fact, we're going to be talking with Lori Wallach about it tonight on the Temple Vision. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Trans-Atlantic Trade Agreement, TAFTA. Got NAFTA, CAFTA, TAFTA is coming along. I'm still waiting for the Singapore, Honduras, America trade agreement. SHAFTA. Right? So we can say, CAFTA, NAFTA, SHAFTA. Okay, yeah, okay. Bad joke. I'm sorry. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey Marty, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom, sure. Well, recently we've been talking about Corrections Corporation of America and, just the overall privatization of our prisons. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to share a quick story with you that was put out from our local public radio station about a prison in southern Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the story begins with a resident reminiscing about a bad call by an umpire at his daughter's little league game from the late 90s.
Right.
And the bad call was an inmate at the nearby Vienna prison where Whitehead had spent his 30-year career working in the kitchen.
Right.
So everyone in this area is just used to having inmates as umpires. As I grew up, they were umpiring my game. So really, they need something else to do besides sit on their duff and do nothing at all.
Right.
And that's just one of the stories on how inmates used to be a vital part of the Vienna community, a small town about 5 hours straight south of Chicago near the Kentucky border.
Mm-hmm.
So then it tells another story that seems even harder to believe given the current state of Illinois Department of Corrections. In 1988, this lady had a pain in her chest, and she thought she was going to have a heart attack, so she called for an ambulance, and it was inmates who came and took her to the hospital just across the state line in Paducah, Kentucky.
Hmm.
So prisoners provided her medical care and then took her out of state. And she was quoted as saying, you didn't know the difference between white or black, convict or non-convict. As long as they were working on you, that was all that mattered. And at the time, the prison in Vienna offered EMT classes, and inmates staffed the ambulance service in Johnson County, Illinois. And that's just how it was, and people can't recall any problems, and it was just one of the connections the community had to the prison. Back then, there wasn't even a fence around the prison, and this wasn't like the early 1900s or anything. This was just 15, 20, 25 years ago.
Right.
So, and now with current cuts to budgets, 98% of the department's budget goes to basically keeping the lights on, and only 2% goes to programming for inmates. But, it's just a thought on, the potential that, that we're just wasting by, by having for-profit corporations basically run our prison system.
Yeah. I think that if we lived in a society where prison inmates were rare, like in the rest of the developed world, I mean, we have more prisoners both in absolute numbers and on a per capita basis than any other country on earth. If we lived in a society where prisoners were few and far between, then having the occasional prisoner, in the local community doing something that arguably is taking a job away from a person who's not a prisoner, but arguably isn't because that prisoner is eventually going to be out of prison and now he's or she is qualified for a job and they're rehabilitated and there's a societal good to that, makes a lot of sense. On the other hand, when you've got a massive prison population like we have in the United States, and you've got some of these for-profit companies now starting to run businesses. They're building furniture. They're building lawnmowers. I mean, they're competing in the marketplace with for-profit companies that used to have factories here in the United States no longer can afford to because they can't compete with prison labor. So they've either gone out of business or they're now outsourcing to China or something. That is arguably not a good thing. But interesting story. So, Marty, are the prisoners no longer working in your community? What has happened to the prisons?
Well, I live in Upper Chicago, but they were just reporting on, you know, prison, the prison conditions in Illinois. So anyway, so it said the inmate, Paul Lee, says he's willing to work, and or this guy that they interviewed said he's willing to work any job when he leaves prison, but now that they've cut all the training programs, it hinders him, it hinders the ability to find work after he gets out of prison. Which, you know, I guess kind of perpetuates.
Yeah, then recidivism goes up. People reoffending. Yeah, absolutely. Interesting point. Marty, thank you for the call and sharing that with us. Chris, in Federal Way, Washington, you have a better way to win carbon arguments with Republicans?
Yes, I always change it to something that they understand and can't really argue with. It is a ridiculous business model to take your company's resource and burn it. It is a finite commodity. When we call it black gold, it truly is. Once it's gone, it's going to be gone. We can't replace that. There are so many uses for petroleum and coal and other fossil fuels. It only makes sense if you're a CEO of a petroleum company to be burning your company's resource if you're only worried about a very short-term gain. If we did not subsidize the extraction of fossil fuels, it would not, they couldn't make a profit off of it.
Yeah, I agree. And not just subsidize it, but, you know, give our fossil fuels to them for pennies on the dollar and our public lands.
Exactly. It's all of our fossil fuel, but how come they get the profits off of it? It's when they externalize the cost of it to us, but then they get all of the profits. It's a ridiculous business model. If you're looking at, you know, like companies in Japan have 30 and 100 year plans. If you're only worried about this quarter and the next quarter, sure, it's okay to get the money out of it right now. If you're looking at your company's long range plans, you're going to take the resource that you've somehow, you know, grabbed and you're going to burn that. No other company except militaries produce something for destruction.
Yeah.
Literally for destruction. We could recycle. Every time you make something plastic out of it, that can be recycled and used for generations and generations. But there are so many products that are made from petroleum that people don't even think about. Medicine, you know, fertilizer, just thousands of them, literally. To burn it wouldn't burn gold. We would not gold.
Yeah, I'm with you. Chris, excellent point, and you're right. It is a crazy business model. Let me add to it, by the way. It's not just the resource that you're burning. It's fossils. We have built a civilization on fossils. There is a limited supply of fossils.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a couple of quick FYIs. Ed Snowden has three countries now that are saying, fine, come on over. Only problem? There's no airplane that'll get him there without having to stop someplace where either us, the United States, or some country that is beholden to us or friendly to us can say, no, you can't fly over the top of our country. And countries have absolute control over their airspace. So for the moment, Ed Snowden is trapped in the Moscow airport. Unless he figures out some way to smuggle himself out on an Aeroflot flight as baggage or something. That could be like a Bad Lucy show episode, I suppose. But how does he do that? Maybe he does it without anybody knowing he's done it. I mean, you know, if he was on an Aeroflot flight or any other flight from Moscow to Cuba and then from Cuba to Venezuela or, you know, one of the other countries, and nobody knew he was on the plane. I mean, it's not like they're stopping every single plane that's going out of Moscow. So I'm half expecting that one of these days we're going to hear, you know, he's just going to pop up and say, ta-da, here I am in Caracas. Because I do think that at some point, Mr. Putin's patience is going to wear thin. Although, who knows? It's just it's a fascinating thing. Far more important, of course, I mean, this is the part, this is the bright, shiny, dangly part that all the U.S. media is going to be paying attention to, is, you know, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? Where in the world is Ed Snowden? But the more important part is the things that he's telling us about what our own country is doing. I had Amy Stepanovich on our TV show day before yesterday, I believe it was. She's with the EPIC and EPIC, this organization that does basically Fourth Amendment privacy stuff. And they are now suing the federal government, the NSA, because, you know, before when they tried suing the government said, well, you can't prove that we're wiretapping you. And EPIC has lawyers that defend whistleblowers, NSA whistleblowers. And the government was saying, well, you can't prove that we're wiretapping you, lawyers for whistleblowers. And because you can't prove it, you can't sue us because you have no standing. Now they have standing because Ed Snowden said, here's the proof. So it's like stuff is happening. Stuff is changing. And I think for the better. This is not stuff that's helping terrorists. This is stuff that is helping America become the ideal that the founders established, a transparent, small-d democracy, small-r republic. But that said, the human drama of, you know, where is Ed Snowden is still just, you know, fascinating thing. On the George Zimmerman trial, any moment now, I'm guessing, they will be adjourning the trial for the day. The judge's instructions to the jury, there was a long, drawn-out debate this morning about what should be said to the jury about, you know, in the jury instructions. The prosecution even wanted there to be child abuse charges because Trayvon Martin was under 18, third-degree murder with child abuse. But the judge said, you can, to the jury, basically, these are not her exact words, but, you know, the jury instructions would include, you can find him guilty of manslaughter. Now, I'm not representing myself as a legal expert here, although there is one in the next room, and he will probably correct me if I'm wrong. Shano did graduate from law school. But my understanding is that manslaughter includes things like, you get drunk and behind the wheel of a car and kill somebody accidentally, but, you know, you're being drunk had something to do with it. That's manslaughter. That's not just an accident. And so, you know, it's like killing somebody in circumstances that you really shouldn't have put yourself in. And if George Zimmerman was told, stay in your car, don't follow that guy, and he's following the guy, and he's got a gun, and he's got it loaded, and he's got a bullet in the chamber, and Trayvon Martin ends up dead. If you can't prove that second degree requirement, which is that he was starting out with this kind of poisoned mind, this malicious intent, that his goal was to murder, not necessarily the individual of Trayvon Martin, that would be first degree murder, but his goal, you know, his depraved intent, that his goal was to do something horrible that might include murder. That's second-degree murder. If you can't prove that, and it's increasingly looking to me anyway, as a layman, that that's a pretty damn high bar to jump over. What the defense was saying is it's got to be all or nothing. It's either got to be that or you let him go. And the prosecution was saying, no, let the jury decide if he's guilty of that or of manslaughter. And manslaughter in Florida carries a 30-year penalty. In fact, when the judge pointed that out today, the defense attorney said, wait a minute, 30 years? Or words to that effect. And she said, yep. So I actually watched that little piece on the TV machine. So my money would be on a manslaughter conviction if I was a betting person. I don't know if InTrade still does that kind of stuff, but not that I'm going to go over there anyway. But we'll see. But that was a pretty big deal. when the judge allowed that. I mean, it was expected. You know, we've had Debbie Hines on here, and she's said, you know, expect this kind of thing. And there was a lot of speculation about it. But the judge just as easily could have said, no, it's all or nothing. She could have gone with the defense's desire. So we'll see how this all plays out. Danielle just brought me this from Politico. The House narrowly approved a pared-back farm bill after Republican leaders, that would be Boehner and Cantor and McCarthy, stripped out the nutrition title to win conservative votes. Now, here's what that means. The vote, by the way, was 216 to 208, which means virtually all the Democrats and even some of the Republicans voted against it. But it passed. Now, the farm bill has two pieces. One piece of it is, here's a whole bunch of money to ConAgra and Archer's Daniel Midland and Monsanto and all these big corporations that do food. Right? Here's subsidies to the ag industry. And there's some subsidies to small farmers as well, price support and you know, protecting farmers who get hit by drought or floods and things like that. I mean, there's some good stuff in there to keep small farms in business, but most of it is pork for giant food producers. And then the other part of the farm bill is food stamps for poor people, mostly children, and school lunch programs. And the way historically the Democrats were able to get Republicans to vote for food stamps and school lunch programs was by putting them in the same bill with the money that goes to the multimillionaire and billionaire agriculture industry that, you know, the Republicans like. Because the Republicans hate food stamps and the idea that poor people are getting decent nutrition. You can't have that. They'll just sit on their butts all day long in the Republican mind. So for the first time ever, as far as I know, I may be wrong on this, but I've been watching this stuff for a lot of years. For the first time ever, the Republicans have succeeded in separating the two so that they could pass the part for the millionaire and billionaire farmers, which includes some members of Congress, and ignore the part about food stamps and school lunch programs. Now, they are not saying they're ignoring it. They're saying they will debate it as a separate piece of legislation on another occasion, maybe someday, maybe next week, maybe next month, maybe next year. Maybe when the cows come home, we'll see. Bad farm bill pun. But this is what happened.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You would think at some point there's some critical threshold where Americans, average working Americans, would wake up and say, you know, the Republicans only give a hoot about the rich people. Indeed, it's Thursday, so I get my 3 minutes of geeky science that Louise and Sean allow me to have every week. Oh, boy, geeky science. Everyone remembers seeing Jurassic Park and being amazed by the idea that dinosaurs, which have been extinct for 65 million years, could be magically brought back to life. It wasn't magic. Scientifically brought back to life to roam the Earth once again. When that movie came out in 1993, boy, it's been a long time, hasn't it? The idea was just science fiction. The movie's release even prompted scientists to point out that DNA could not exist and stay intact for thousands of years, let alone millions. But times have changed. And collecting DNA from ancient organisms is getting easier and easier to do. In 2010, a team of researchers from the Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Deutschland, in Germany, revealed that they had sequenced the entire genome of a Neanderthal. That's Neanderthalus, Homo Neanderthalus, the Neanderthal. Sometimes you say it falls, but in Germany they say tall, and that's where it was found. Anyway, based on specimens that were 38,000 years old. Last year, that same team announced that it had sequenced the genome of a girl belonging to a species of humans called the Denisovans, closely related to the Neanderthals, but who lived about 80,000 years ago. Now, a team of scientists at Copenhagen University in Denmark have announced that they have successfully sequenced the entire genome of a species of horse that lived some 700,000 years ago. And in late May, researchers discovered a nearly fully intact woolly mammoth body frozen deep in the wilderness of Siberia. blood and muscle of the mammoth was incredibly well preserved, so much so that despite the freezing temperatures, the mammoth's blood was still liquid and leaking from under the body. Researchers are going to use that blood to help them understand the woolly mammoth's DNA so that maybe they could clone a mammoth. So what's the benefit of understanding and sequencing the DNA of all these prehistoric animals and human predecessors? In the case of the Neanderthals, maybe it'd be a good thing to reintroduce them to society. Scientific evidence shows that Neanderthals actually had bigger brains than you and me, modern-day humans, by about 100 cc's. And because of these larger brains, it's possible that they were smarter than we are. Really? It might be when modern-day humans, Homo sapiens, clashed with the Neanderthals that we used violence while they used their intelligence, while they tried to reason with us, and it didn't work out so well for them. I think Darwin's Radio was, I think Greg Bear wrote that book. It was a fascinating book. Anyway, bottom line here is that a higher developed species like Homo Neanderthalus might even be necessary to help save the planet. I mean, if they really are smarter than us, and we could clone them. So next time you say to someone, "You're such a Neanderthal," just remember, it may actually be a compliment. Okay, our geeky science for the day. They would have to, you know, a human woman would have to carry that. It's like the woolly mammoth. They're going to have, if they clone the woolly mammoth, and there's serious discussion about it, they're going to do it in an elephant, which is closely related to it. Boy, would that be strange. Now, that's why it's not going to happen, is because it involves human beings, at least not here in the United States. It's like, you know, medical ethics and all that. But I think it would be fascinating. Wouldn't it be fascinating? They also say Neanderthals had red hair. And that the red hair gene, one of the pieces of evidence that Neanderthals and humans actually interbred is that some humans have red hair. And they might be smarter. Makes you kind of want to have red hair. Anyhow, Greg in Candor, North Carolina. Hey, Greg, you wanted to talk about Moral Monday. How's it going in your state?
Kind of slow, Tom. What I was calling you about was today on our local TV stations that they said on the, our representative has passed the bill now that people that's on, like welfare, mm-hmm. and I'm on welfare, I'm on SSI.
Mm-hmm. And well, you're not on welfare, you're on Social Security Disability Insurance.
I get public assistance, you
right.
know, like heat and fuel and stuff
sure.
like that. They're gonna make them take a drug test and pay for the drug test yourself, or and if you pass it, you get it reimbursed back to you.
Right
how
after you
people,
fill after you fill out
no
the
money.
Paperwork.
Right. Well, how does people with no money do that?
Right. This is all part of the Republican goal of shaming anybody who gets public assistance. What you're
right.
looking at is the multimillionaires and billionaires in Congress and those multimillionaires and billionaires who support them, who are so offended by the idea that we're taking any of their tax dollars and giving that money to people like you, Greg, who are disabled and in need of actual, you know, little cash assistance to make it through.
Yeah.
They're so offended by that that they want to try and shame you into not taking it. So maybe you'll do like, what's his name here, Ricky Lawrence Gardner, the 49-year-old guy down in Moulton, Alabama, who went in and robbed a bank yesterday just so that he could get put in jail because he couldn't have, you know, he didn't want to be homeless.
Well, right. I'm 60. I get, you know, $710 what I get a month.
Wow.
I live off of.
That's got to be tough.
Some food stamps, you know.
Yeah.
But then they'll start making you take a drug test.
I'm guessing they're not going to come to your home. You're going to have to go someplace to pee in that cup.
I guess you'll go over there when you go over there to get you assistance in the wintertime for your heating fuel.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm guessing they're going to make it even harder for you. And I would bet that for you to get that reimbursement for the expense, if your drug test comes back negative and you qualify for the reimbursement, that they're going to make you fill out a bunch of forms on the assumption that half the people won't fill out the forms And, you know, it's and I'll bet that, you know, like Rick Scott down in Florida, he owns a company that does drug testing. And so he was pushing drug testing like crazy. I'll bet there's some drug testing industry lobbyists involved in this thing, too. So it's like all the rich people win, and the people who genuinely need assistance in this country get screwed. Greg, thanks for the update. It's depressing news, but thanks for sharing it with us and with our listeners and viewers. I appreciate it. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in North Carolina, too. We'll be right back. It's the Tom Hartman Program. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Talk media for the sane among us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And yes, there is an app for that. The Tom Hartman app. It's in the App Store for your iPad and your iPhone. It's free. The bad and the very, very margaritaceously ugly. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. Anyway, the good. The D.C. City Council on Wednesday, lawmakers in the nation's capital approved a bill requiring all retailers with sales of $1 billion or more to pay their employees a living wage. With yesterday's 8-5 vote, the D.C. Council both ensured that the city's workers will make a decent living and all but kicked Walmart out of the capital of the United States. Nation's largest employer announced earlier this week that it would scrap its plans to build 3 stores in the district if city legislatures approved the living wage law. Good work, D.C. City Council. And hopefully, good riddance, Walmart. The bad, Brian Kilmeade. The Fox so-called news host just doesn't spew right-wing misinformation. He also makes babies cry. Seriously, listen to this clip from today's episode of Fox and Friends.
You can't teach that. Actually, his dad, Joe, did.
What could come out of
your You're a machine.
Now?
You're a machine. How do you stop this?
Whoa.
I'm sorry.
That's how he started, Brian.
I'm sorry.
Oh, my God.
See, that's Jordan Rules right there. That's what happened. He's going to face that when he plays ball.
I don't believe it. All right. We'll be right back. We'll see how tight this is.
Right. You know, Brian, I think I empathize with that kid. I feel like breaking into tears every time I watch your show. And the very, very ugly Matt Staver. During yesterday's Faith and Freedom broadcast, the dean of Liberty University's law school warned that a decision to allow a transgendered Colorado boy to use the girls' restroom at a public school was the death of civil rights. Check it out.
If you ultimately have this accepted by society, that a man can be identified as a woman can be identified as a man, and you ought to have civil rights that follow your subjective inner thoughts, then they ultimately create sexual anarchy. If this is civil rights, this is the abolition of civil rights. This is the deconstruction of objective reality. It's a deconstruction of law.
I don't know, Matt. Last time I checked, choosing your own gender was a pretty personal decision. Nobody's asking you if you want to become a woman. They're only asking you to let other people who do want to do that live their lives as they want to, and for all of us to accept them. You know, kind of like Jesus would have wanted. The only person who's actually trying to destroy civil rights here is you, Matt. And if this is what you're teaching your students at Liberty University about the law, then that's just very, very ugly. That's incredible. Okay. Oh, this looks like fun. Tea Party Dave in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, wants to challenge me on my energy policy. Hello, Tea Party Dave.
How are you, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
You might want to call me a Neanderthal.
Oh, because you're smart?
Possibly, but you might use it in the negative terms
Well, tell me, first of all, what is my energy policy that you want to criticize or debate?
I just was listening to it when one gent had called you about the oil companies and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to challenge you about was, and this is just something, because I'd like to see you lead the way, so to speak, how many windmills do you got on top of your building there?
I have none. Several of my neighbors have vehicles that are 100% wind powered, but mine is not.
No, you're building. So there's none on the. How many solar panels up there?
None.
Oh, okay. So how are you powering up your studio there?
Well, here in Washington, D.C., you can actually check the little box and say, we'll pay a little bit more, and we want 100% renewable electricity. If I was in a position to be able to do that, I would. Unfortunately, we're in a building where the cost of electricity is built into our rent, so I have no idea if our landlord, which is the Heritage Foundation, is choosing to do that or not. I'm guessing that they don't. But you know, a lot of places in this country, you can check that box. When we lived in Portland, I always checked that box. I paid extra to get electricity that, and it was a very small extra, actually, because it was mostly hydro, and it was not that much more expensive. But I paid extra to get renewable energy. What's your point, Dave?
Well, I'm just saying is that if you're going to espouse all these reasons, well, how many Chevy Volts are there in Washington?
Okay. Yeah, let me point out the flaw in your logic.
You just espoused all.
No, Dave, hang on just a second. Let me, if I may. And you know, I'm not going to hang up on you here. Just to hold on for a second. What you're basically saying is that if somebody doesn't walk their talk, they have no right to say the talk. Is that basically it?
No. I'm saying that the left, and it can be done by anyone, but I hear it mostly from it's mostly a policy of do as I say, not as I do.
Right, that's what I just said. If you don't walk your talk, you shouldn't be talking the talk. And
right. You want to put a carbon tax on everyone, but I hear you
including me.
Flying off to here, flying off to there, flying off. You know, I have never rode in an airplane in my life.
Okay.
So, I mean, how are you
flying in an airplane is actually more efficient in terms of carbon use per mile than driving a car, first of all. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, all of this entire argument you're making is a straw man. And okay. I'm guessing you don't realize this, Dave, but just think about it for a minute. It is not your actions or my actions that are going to change the level of carbon use in the United States, or even Al Gore's actions, or even somebody who uses an absurd amount of carbon, you know, somebody who owns their own, you know, 300-foot yacht, you know, the billionaire who started whatever the company was out there on the West Coast, Google. It is instead government policy. And therefore, if we want to change the fact that we have a country that is based on fossil fuels, that our economy is running on fossil fuels, and much of our industry is running on fossil fuels, if we want to change that, we have to change that at the level of policy. So to criticize somebody who is aggressively trying to change policy through the political process, which is how it will actually change. It's how George Herbert Walker Bush got rid of acid rain with cap and trade for sulfur dioxide. By criticizing somebody who's trying to change policy for not magically themselves having been able to step outside of that policy is, as I said, a straw man argument.
Why is that?
Because it's irrelevant. The amount of carbon that I use is not going to change whether or not another superstorm hits your town.
Like me, I'm actually a very poor working person, very poor. Why do you force me to abide by all your rules?
My rules? If what you're saying, Dave, is what you're saying
that a windmill, I have to use solar panel or else.
Okay, if what you're
am I supposed to, even if I have to pay more, and how does taxing or making a poor person pay more, isn't that more hurtful than it is like for people
it would
like
be? I don't think that we should
can afford it. Yeah,
Dave,
sure.
Dave, I don't think that we should ask poor people to pay more. I agree with Bernie Sanders on this, that as we make the transition from the buggy whip economy to a 21st century economy, from one form of energy to another, that those people who can't really afford to make that transition, we should help them out. That we should be giving tax credits or even outright payments to people who have to drive a long way to get to work, to people who live in the Northeast or anywhere in the North, and it costs them a lot to heat their homes, that we should be doing this transition in such a way that people like yourself are not going to be hit with an extra burden. And yet at the same time, as a nation, we're no longer going to be dependent upon the Osama bin Ladens of the world for our fuel.
Right. I could 100, it's the only part I think we can agree, that I think we should be getting our own fuels and our own energy, not being cut off by the Fed by restricting this land and grabbing it. If you say it belongs to the commons, then we should all be using it.
If it works to the benefit of our society, we shouldn't be using it if it harms our society. I mean,
How does it harm?
Simple principle. Well, first of all, when you burn fossil fuels, the dirty fossil fuels like in particular coal, but also oil, when you burn them, you produce a lot of particulate matter that is poisonous. You can't eat the fish in the United States anymore. There's not a single lake or river in this country that has fish in it that don't have mercury levels that if you consume them on a regular basis, you will cause neurological damage to yourself and probably severe damage to your kids, number one. And those companies are not paying for that. You and I are paying for that. People who have neurologically damaged children are paying for that. You know, so number one. Number two, you've got other kinds of particulate matter, arsenic and you know, other cancer causing chemicals that are coming out of these plants. Again, these companies are not paying for it. Their externalities are being paid for, Dave, by you and by me. We pay our taxes so these people show up in the emergency room, or we pay extra taxes so that neurologically damaged children who cost much, much more to educate in the public schools, you and I are paying for that, not the oil companies or the coal companies.
Oh, I hear you saying we're paying.
We're paying with our property taxes, absolutely.
We're paying.
And the oil and gas and coal companies should be paying for it. And if you're looking at gas, at natural gas, you know, there are all kinds of externalities associated with that.
So every time we come up with a new fuel or a new energy that the left doesn't like, you want to do everything in the world to stop
this. This has got nothing to do with left or right, Dave. This has to do with if you're going to produce energy, you pay for the costs associated with it. I'm just saying, let's stop the free ride for the oil companies, the gas companies, and the coal companies. Let's stop the free ride. We don't give a free ride to solar companies. We don't give a free ride to windmill companies. Why are we giving these guys a free ride? I don't get it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The only industry in America that is not paid to dispose of its waste is the fossil fuel industry. You and I pay to dispose of that waste in the cost of hurricanes and cancers.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hey, Michael, what's up?
First thing I want to say is I hope your broken shoulder gets better.
Thank you. It's not broken. It's there's a little tiny muscle in the front of the shoulder called the infraspinatus, and I joined this gym and I pulled on a machine the wrong way and I partially tore that muscle. And if I can keep from tearing it the whole way, it'll heal itself and all will be well. And if I don't, then I get to get surgery. So that's why I'm wearing this sling and treating my shoulder.
Good luck, because I had a busted shoulder and wore the same type of swing.
Yeah,
but here's my,
thank you.
Here's my point, which is actually important. And you could tell this to the libertarians, too. You can actually, I'm very left, so you can actually have no minimum wage, make the minimum wage zero, and achieve basically progressive wages, no unemployment, et cetera. You just do what the country you've lived in probably the most, Germany, does. What you do is you say that 49% of the voting rights of every corporation that employs more than 2,000 people will be basically held by workers' representatives throughout.
That's right.
If you do that, take Walmart, for example. People will now get a wage that will limit the profits of the people at top, but won't be so high that they won't have jobs. And the Germans have done this successfully for a long time, and now their unemployment rate is really 5%, and ours is really 10%.
Yeah, ours is arguably really more like 16 or 17.
They had no outsourcing because the 49% would not permit it, whereas we had plenty of outsourcing.
Yeah.
The Germans in this regard are far more advanced than we'd ever dream of being, and it's time we do that. I have other points too, but that's the one I wanted to make.
And I think it's a really important one, and it's, I'm really glad that you called, Michael, to point that out, because most Americans have no idea that German corporations, large German corporations, half of their board of directors half of their voting board of directors have to be made up of representatives from organized labor within workers who work in that company. And the consequence of that is that companies make decisions based on what's best for the company and for the community rather than what's best for the CEO or the dividend at the end of the quarter. And what most Americans also don't realize is that Harry Truman tried to propose this for Americans back in the early 50s, and right. The Republicans would have nothing to do with it. They couldn't get through Congress, nothing like that. The Germans were rewriting their Constitution. They turned to the United States and said, give us a little assistance. And Harry Truman said, you know what you really ought to do? You ought to put in your Constitution that your big corporations, they have to have 50% labor, that you have an absolute right to unionization in your Constitution, a constitutional right to unionization, and that you have a constitutional right to health care. And the Germans put those things in their constitution, and they've been doing just fine ever since. Thank you very much.
The other thing is it makes Germany almost like a state of cooperatives because now the big corporations have to equally just about act in the interest of their workers as well as, you know, the capital.
That's right. And with small corporations, you know, with a small company, it's like, you know, we've got this small company here, and every day I have to look at Shano and I have to talk to Jim, and I'm, you know, if we were actively screwing our employees, I think, you know, life would be uncomfortable. So, you know, and in fact, Shano just said, Michael, you get the book today, so we're going to give you a copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. I'm going to put you on hold here. Michael's on line 7. And thank you, Shano. But my point is that small companies tend to treat their workers well. You know, assuming that they have the means to. And large companies, the ones where the employers can be in distant, anonymous places, the Germans have figured out a way around that by making sure that workers are on the board of directors. And it's just like, this is common sense, guys. This is just common sense. Steve in Weiser, Idaho. Hey, Steve, what's on? What's up?
Hey, this is Weiser.
Weiser, my apologies.
Yeah, but I wish the folks around here would be a little wiser because, like, they're all Republicans and conservatives.
Of course.
And I call conservatives evil homos because, like, evil is fake and excuse for very real, very powerful force of fear, ignorance, hate, and greed.
Uh-huh.
The force to feel conservative gangster.
And in homo, you mean as in genus, not as in the slur for gay people?
No, not. Well, when it comes to sexuality, I think they just wish the homo heterosexuals around.
Yeah, because you were calling about Neanderthals, so I'm assuming you're talking about the difference between Homo sapiens and Homo Neanderthalus.
Yeah, we're actually Homo sapiens sapiens.
Right, like, the wise humans.
But like, in this Discover magazine issue a couple months ago, we had about anywhere from 3 out of Africa homos. Or sapiens have anywhere from 3 to 6% Neanderthal DNA, and also Dovinians, which you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also little links to other things, but I have red chin hair, and my grandma has red hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Neanderthals should be called other races of homos.
Mm-hmm.
And like erectus and Homo forensis and all those other homos should be called other races of homos. They should be called other different flavors of sapiens. It's because of speciation, the primary fuel for the ever-running engine of evolution.
Yeah. So you're guessing that all these relatively recent variations on the genus Homo were actually sentient. They were sapiens, the wise, smart.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just as like I mean,
and that they interbred with us because we're carrying their DNA.
You said that we were apes that used to live in water for a few generations.
No, I said that's one theory, the aquatic ape theory. I don't endorse it. I think it makes a lot of sense, but I don't know.
It's like when you've been in the water, swim for a long time, hands get all wrinkly. Mm. We used to live in the water, hands are all wrinkly. My half brother Hank has webbed toes. It's called Cernomelia when members of our species are born from our mate.
That'll do it. That'll do it. Steve, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. And fascinating stuff. Coming up tomorrow, it's Brunch with Bernie. Friday, of course, it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be here for our national town hall meeting. Get your questions ready. Plus, anything goes summer. Tomorrow's Friday. So what's on your mind? And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require you participating. So find an organization, get some people together, show up, get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.